Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I don't believe a single game in the Five Nights at Freddy's series has carried as much narrative weight or as much to prove as The Secret of the Mimic. While there are certainly defenders of the Steel Wool era, it's fair to say that a significant portion of the gaming community views this chapter of the franchise as, frankly, mediocre. Help Wanted was an exceptional entry, albeit somewhat overrated when you consider that much of its game design was pre-established by Scott himself. Functionally, it served as a VR remaster of the earlier titles, but nonetheless delivered a polished and immersive experience. For those seeking to revisit the classic gameplay loop of FNAF, it remains the definitive format. Accessible, refined, and viscerally effective. Security Breach, on the other hand, was a fundamentally broken experience. Regardless of how one attempts to reframe the narrative surrounding its development, whether it was a product of external pressure from Sony, a lack of clear direction from Scott, or simply Steel Wool's overambition, the final product was deeply flawed at a foundational level. That much is incontrovertible. Ruin was a more favorable reception upon release, particularly for its introduction of the Mimic, a character that reignited interest in the lore for many new to the fandom. However, it leaned far too heavily on external media to fill in its narrative gaps for casual fans of the series who only play the games. Though it garnered widespread praise within the community, I would argue much of it stemmed from the game simply being a smoother, less buggy experience than Security Breach. Strip that already pre-existing low bar away, and what remains is a sparse, linear experience. More walking simulator than horror game, to be honest. Where the tension feels muted and the answers few and far between for the story. It presented a facade of depth, but not much else. Then we arrive at Help Wanted 2, which, let's be honest, is a diluted version of its predecessor in nearly every aspect. As I've outlined before in my last review, it's largely composed of low-stakes minigames that lack tension or atmosphere. The overarching narrative is both negligible and self-defeating. Vanny's defeat of the Glitch Trap virus, despite never doing anything particularly meaningful while under its influence in the first place, and when contextualized alongside the Tales from the Pizzaplex novellas, particularly The Storyteller and The Mimic. Help Wanted 2 retroactively undermines both itself and the character of Vanny. I mean, what is truly lost if both Vanny and the Help Wanted duology are removed from the larger canon? The answer? Not much at all.
Whoa! This is worthless.
It's less than worthless, my boy!
Factor in the Mimic reveal, a moment that, rather than unifying the fandom around a long-awaited answer, instead ignited a firestorm of confusion and frustration among large swaths of the player base. Why? Because unless you had read a stack of novels totaling nearly $80 at retail, you would have no way of knowing this character existed, let alone that it was central to the unfolding narrative. And nowhere in the game are players informed that they should do their literary homework as a prerequisite for understanding a $40 horror title. The Mimic's inclusion effectively bifurcated the community, one already long fractured over a litany of grievances. Cassidy theories, the interpretive nightmare that is the survival logbook, the ambiguity of book canonicity, conflicting ideas about plot direction, concerns over writing quality, the infantilization of the series, the evolution, or depending on who you ask, the decline of the gameplay design, and above all else, the prolonged radio silence for both Scott Cawthon and Steel Wool regarding what is, at this point, a labyrinthian, internally inconsistent franchise. This confusion is compounded when you consider we had the Into the Pit book, then a game called Into the Pit, followed in that same year by a choose-your-own-adventure book titled Return to the Pit, itself a reimagining of Into the Pit. Which of these three are canon? Are any of them canon? Who knows? So, when Steel Wool announces a new game titled Secret of the Mimic, it's no wonder that longtime fans waited with bated breath. This finally could be the turning point. The trailer drops, and for a moment, it feels like the prayers of a fandom have been answered. Gone is the bright plastic sheen of the Pizzaplex. In its place, darker, more claustrophobic environments of the MCM facility. Gone is the diluted PG approach to horror. In its place, genuine tension, unease, and a return to the grim atmosphere that defined the early titles. The gameplay, too, seemed promising, offering what older fans had been pleading for since the franchise was handed off to a full-scale studio. And perhaps most critically, for lore enthusiasts, Secret of the Mimic had the potential to finally address the elephant in the room, where exactly the games and the books meet, and whether the long, exhausting cycle of retcons, dropped ideas, and vague narrative gestures would give way to actual, concrete storylines and foundational world-building. Now, the game is here. I've played it once, technically twice, more on that later, and within mere hours of release, YouTube's own Fusion Z Gamer had uploaded the entire playthrough, thumbnail spoilers and all, with zero shame. So, did this game bring Five Nights at Freddy's back to its roots? Did it finally put the narrative back on track, mending the gaping holes in continuity and rewarding fans for years of debate, theorycrafting, and blind loyalty? Well, we got a good-ass game at the very least. Right, out of the gate, I want to make it clear. I do like this game, despite its flaws. And yes, it absolutely has them. From a gameplay and atmospheric standpoint, The Secret of the Mimic, or SOTM as I will call it for the remainder of this review, lays promising groundwork. The direction it takes suggests a studio that finally understands the tone and pace in this series has been sorely missing. The initial trailer sold me hard on its premise, so much so that I set aside my prior resolution to abstain from purchasing future SteelWool titles. For once, it felt like the developers had listened. Gone was the bright, child-centric veneer of the Pizzaplex. In its place was a claustrophobic, unwelcoming industrial sprawl, where you feel small not merely because you're playing as a child, but because you're being hunted by something that knows the terrain, holds all the cards, and isn't afraid to use them. However, and this is critical, as someone who has made his mark in the FNAF community by crafting long-form podcast narratives chronicling the stories and characters of this universe, it should come as no surprise that my priorities lean heavily toward the quality of the storytelling, and this is where the game falters. The best analogy I can offer is this. Secret of the Mimic is SteelWool's FNAF 4. Its gameplay and ambiance are genuinely stellar. The emotional and thematic core of the story is strong, but the lore and the world-building, the connective tissue that binds this title to the rest of the series, that is where it begins to crack. Whereas FNAF 4 suffered from excessive obfuscation, hiding too much behind cryptic symbolism and vague implications, SOTM's primary failings is the opposite. It boldly rewrites established facts without doing the necessary narrative legwork to justify those changes. And in a franchise so famously defined by its intricate lore, such decisions threaten to unravel the very fabric of what keeps long-time fans invested. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's begin this review properly by evaluating SOTM across five pillars that, in my view, any great FNAF title must stand on: atmosphere, gameplay, performance, story, and finally, of course, the lore.
The lore! Guys, the lore!
Let us begin with a brief overview of the plot itself. Set in the earliest point we've seen in the Five Nights at Freddy's timeline, specifically the year 1979, The secret of the mimic unfolds throughout the perspective of a Fazbear engineer named Arnold. Arnold is an overworked, down-on-his-luck technician, barely holding it together while enduring 30-hour shifts for a company that knows he's living out of the back of his work truck, and they leverage that vulnerability to their full advantage. If Arnold refuses orders, Fazbear Entertainment threatens to dock his already meager pay and repossess the only home he has. On what was supposed to be his final run for the day, presumably en route to a parking lot for some desperately needed rest, Arnold receives a last-minute transmission from Fazbear Dispatch. They inform him, with the monotone indifference we've come to expect from this corporation.
Oh, I hate you.
Amazing.
That he must complete one final task before clocking out, retrieving the schematics for an experimental endoskeleton developed by a now-missing contractor named Edwin Murray. Murray's factory, also known as Murray's Costume Manor, also known as MCM, now lies in complete disrepair, abandoned and rotting from the inside out. Upon entering the facility, Arnold finds himself trapped, the doors locking behind him. Dispatch then casually informs him that the prototype endoskeleton, codenamed The Mimic, is not only still active somewhere inside the building, but has become aggressively homicidal, attacking any individual it perceives as an intruder and stuffing them inside of a costume suit. To survive, Arnold must use a specialized tool known as the Data Diver to gradually increase his security clearances throughout the facility. Only by reaching Murray's executive suite and downloading the blueprints into his device will Arnold be granted clearance to leave the complex alive. But all the while, he must avoid detection by the Mimic itself, a highly adaptive machine capable of donning any costume it finds in the decrepit factory and mimicking not only the appearance, but the personality of that character in order to stalk, deceive, and eliminate its prey. And that, without question, is SOTM's greatest triumph, at least on your first playthrough, its atmosphere and setting. Not since Help Wanted as a FNAF title so effectively immersed me in a world where I genuinely felt vulnerable, boxed in, and outmatched, and not since Sister Location have I found myself utterly captivated by a game's environment. SOTM clearly draws inspiration from Alien Isolation, a title I'd highly recommend if this game resonated with you, and vice versa. That influence doesn't just inform gameplay mechanics, however. It seeps into the very framework of the world. Just as the xenomorph in Alien stalks the Sevastopol station with terrifying unpredictability, the Mimic transforms the MCM facility into an absolutely incredible hunting ground. At any given moment, from any of the countless costumes lying throughout the complex, he can emerge, utterly transforming the dynamic of whatever room you're in. Yes, there are linear segments and safe areas the Mimic cannot access, hallways and connecting vents, maintenance crawl spaces, and so forth. But for the most part, when you enter in a new zone, that creeping question of, where is he gonna show up, becomes the dominating force behind every decision. And what a battleground the game gives us. MCM is beautiful in the most macabre ways, claustrophobic, labyrinthian, and infused with the disordered genius of a mad inventor. The props, the tools, half-finished projects just laying about, all left behind in a chaotic sprawl only decipherable by those who once worked alongside Edwin Murray himself. And even then, just barely. It is a space that feels not only lived in, but abandoned, haunted not by ghosts, but by unfinished thoughts and the echoes of industry long since collapsed. But, you know, there are also ghosts here too. The setting also leans wonderfully into the 1970s aesthetic. Like Sister Location, it evokes a retro-futuristic vision of advanced technology. But while Sister Location plays into the realm of sleek sci-fi excess, MCM grounds itself into a more analog realism. Think Star Trek the Motion Picture meets War Games. Green text on monochrome CRTs, beige panels galore, blinking lights without much reasoning behind them. Again, Alien franchise inspired. Now, that being said, it's not my favorite location in the series. That honor still belongs to Circus Baby's Entertainment and Rentals. And that's largely because of the mystique Sea Bear still holds. Years after its introduction, we're still uncovering hidden lore and secrets buried beneath its sterile metal floors. It's a location that continues to offer more stories, new lore, and awesome reveals even a half a decade later since its inception. Hell, without spoilers, we technically get even more lore on sea bears, even in this game. MCM, by contrast, opts for a leave-no-stone-unturned approach. Steel Wool wanted us to see everything as it pertained to the factory, and while that's not inherently a flaw, it does mean the location is a one-time visit, and that's really my only problem. There's little mystery left in the location in of itself. What you see is what you get. And what you get is fantastic, don't get me wrong. But it may never have the opportunity to grow in a legend the way Seabird has. But I guess that's not really a flaw given the fact that I wanted more of the location and I wanted to be able to go back to it. You know, which is the true shame because I really do adore this place. There are so many standout environments. The Big Top Showroom, the Doll Hospital, the mysterious B2 sublevel, and of course, research and development. The facility is so unique and offers such a unique landscape not seen in the indie horror scene. What the hell is that noise? All right. Let's talk about the Huggy Wuggy in the room. I don't think it's unfair to acknowledge that SOTM shares a number of similarities with a certain other franchise in the indie horror scene. And frankly, the irony is almost poetic. Poppy Playtime, after all, wears its Five Nights at Freddy's inspiration so openly it's in its eponymous character. I mean, come on, Poppy is quite transparently Mob Entertainment's spin on Circus Baby. Throw in a deep underground facility teeming with immoral experimentation, with the veneer of childhood entertainment, and we're practically back in sister location territory. But the mimicry doesn't stop there. Garten of Ban Ban borrowed liberally from Poppy, which itself took notes from Bendy and the Ink Machine, which, need I say it, also owes much of its conceptual DNA to Five Nights at Freddy's. Now, to be clear, I'm not here to argue that FNAF invented the concept of a hidden underground facility where abominations of mankind's own hubris lurk. Well, that's a long invention. That idea isn't exclusive to any one series. And in fact, I've got an upcoming Shadow Scrying episode in the works that dives into why this concept is so widespread. Likewise, the narrative archetype of the inventor whose creations turn against them is a tale as old as the written word itself. Horror, science, fiction, fantasy, drama, etc. It's a trope that's existed and will continue to be recycled ad infinitum. My point isn't that Poppy Playtime should be accused of unoriginality for playing in FNAF's sandbox, nor that FNAF is ripping off other games in the same market. Rather, when every major indie horror game starts circling the same thematic drain, mascot horror wrapped in layers of corporate cynicism, childhood nostalgia twisted into nightmare fuel, and thinly veiled commentary on exploitation, the death of innocence, you're going to start running into similar ideas and, by extension, similar concepts for settings. And while I think it's absolutely fair for FNAF to take a swing at the haunted toy factory trope once, after all, it's the franchise that stirred the indie horror mascot boom in the first place, it's just the concept has been done again and again and again. It's not really FNAF's fault, but if we're going to keep exploring industrial horror with themes of consumerism and greed, maybe it's time to, I don't know, branch out? I mean, if you want to keep the warehouse aesthetic, try a shipping fulfillment center. You'll still get your mechanical dread and dehumanizing corporate structure, but with a fresh spin. Or go bold! What about a zoo, a water park, a museum, or a park? Imagine the potential in environments that aren't sterile concrete corridors built by mad inventors who somehow are just all obsessed with cheating death. There's room to innovate, We don't need to keep revisiting the same underground labyrinth no matter how well designed it is. Let's challenge the genre to evolve. Because if there's anything FNAF has proven, is that indie horror can surprise us when it dares to think differently. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Let's talk gameplay. As I've mentioned before, the gameplay loop in Secret of the Mimic is quite literally what many of us thought we were getting with Security Breach, but didn't. Because, well...
Freddy! Freddy, you bitch! Freddy! Freddy!
And Ruin, as much as I appreciate its aesthetic and improvements, it was essentially a walking simulator with horror elements sprinkled on top. In contrast, SOTM thrives on momentum. It borrows the constant forward motion philosophy from Ruin, but executes it far more effectively, as well as adding in the explorative elements attempted in Security Breach, but through a more Metroidvania-style design philosophy. There's no expansive overworld to trudge across for several minutes just to reach your objective. Instead, the MCM facility is designed with compactness in mind. Tight, interconnected sections where the emphasis is on quality over quantity, and that focus pays off. The game offers a rich array of tense, thoughtfully designed arenas where you and the Mimic engage in a continuous game of cat and mouse, and more often than not, it is a blast. The core gameplay loop is refreshingly straightforward but highly effective. You need to upgrade your data diver tool, your key to progressing through the facility. Dispatch sends you to various parts of the warehouse, and wherever you go, you'll almost certainly encounter the Mimic. Sometimes he's lurking among shelves and boxes while you solve a puzzle, other times he's actively blocking your path, forcing you to rethink your route, strategy, or timing. Either way, you'll know when you've entered what I like to call a cat-and-mouse section, the game's bread-and-butter gameplay loop, when you're surrounded by a menagerie of lifeless costumes. One of my favorite moments came at exactly 1 a.m. when I first entered the lobby.
Did I do something wrong? Okay, good. You can F right off, game. How about that? You can F right off. You suck so much. Screw you.
The only Mimic I had encountered, not counting Jackie, was in the loading bay, a scripted tutorial moment where he appears inside an elephant costume. So walking into the lobby completely blind, only to find it packed with like 2 dozen costumes, all standing upright and narrow, haphazardly made hiding paths, it was genuinely startled and it put a wide smile on my face. I know he's in one of those suits. I just don't know which one. The environment suddenly feels suffocating and you desperately wished you had eyes in the back of your head. And it creates a sense of dread and anticipation that few FNAF titles have managed to capture so effectively with this new free roam gameplay take. In many ways, SOTM captures a similar tension reminiscent of the original Five Nights at Freddy's. But whereas the dread in those early games stemmed from the inevitability of a jump scare lurking behind every misstep, the suspense here revolves around where the Mimic will strike next. Its genius isn't just in the fear of the unknown, but in the anticipation of it. The Mimic can manifest itself in any one of the costumes scattered across his designated cat and mouse arenas, and even players well-versed in his mechanics can fall prey to him if they miscalculate his location or trigger his appearance mid-sprint. His unpredictability, coupled with the limited information available at any moment, encourages a playstyle that is methodical, slow, and intensely deliberate. You can't just sprint through it all like you could in Security Breach. Okay, so some parts you can absolutely do that, but the game makes an active effort to make sure that those attempts usually result in a game over. To aid in navigation and misdirection, the players have a few tools at their disposal. Chief among them are the wind-up mouse toys found throughout the facility. When thrown, these create an auditory distraction, immediately drawing the mimic's attention. And immediately is an understatement of the century. The mimic is alarming in his speed, far outpacing any of the glam rocks from Security Breach or Ruin. If you get spotted or make a misplay with a distraction, you better have a recovery plan, as you'll be arriving quicker than you'd expect. And there are no stun mechanics here to rectify mistakes, nor allow you to bull run through the cat and mouse sections, which, in my opinion, is both a strength and a missed opportunity. Allow me to elaborate. You see, unlike the Faz Cam or Phaser Blaster from Security Breach, which could be recharged indefinitely and kept on hand simultaneously, and the recharge was automatic, the item system in SOTM is far more strategic and far more balanced. Resource management could actually matter here. That's thanks in large part to the introduction of the inventory tube system. Throughout the MCM facility, players will find hub terminals featuring two core functions, a PC and an inventory tube. The PC simply lets you explore the building's map, view audio text logs found in MCM mailboxes, and access the RetroMoon.exe minigame needed to unlock the secret ending. It also acts as a current quest marker, allowing you to remind yourself on what exactly you're supposed to be doing at a given moment. The inventory tube, however, is where the design really shines. These stations allow players to store or retrieve items they've collected, such as the aforementioned wind-up mice. While the wind-up toys can be found in some puzzle areas, others, like the admin offices, may lack them entirely, meaning you'll need to be proactively transferring them between hubs if you want to use them. Arnold can only carry one item in addition to his data diver, which can make each decision about what to bring to the next room meaningful. It has the potential for an elegant risk-reward mechanic. Do you bring a distraction tool to help you evade the mimic? Or do you venture empty-handed, perhaps needing a free hand for your inventory for a critical puzzle piece? This is precisely why I believe a limited-use stun item wouldn't break the game. It would only enhance it. If balanced correctly, such as the stun tool being a limited resource, such a tool would deepen the decision-making process without undermining the existing tension. Do you bring a rare, limited-use stun item as a panic button, or rely on more renewable but riskier options like the wind-up mice? As it stands, outside of collecting lore tapes or retrieving ball guns or secret collectibles, the inventory tube is underutilized. That's not to say the mechanic is flawed, it's actually one of the smartest design choices in the game, but it does lay a strong foundation for further expansion in future titles, but that deep critical thinking and strategy it could have is just not here yet. But I am excited to see what they do with it if they keep it, which I highly recommend. I mean, imagine for instance integrating a crafting system, where players could combine components to build limited use tools or enhancement. Such a system would incentivize exploration, bolster replayability, and, if paired with a broader variety of animatronic threats, introduce new tactical considerations on every run. Which brings me to my first real nitpick with SOTM, the gameplay loop. Now, I've already said that I genuinely enjoyed facing off against Mimic, and that still holds true. I'm not walking back against that. But I'd be dishonest if I didn't admit that over the course of the 12 hours it takes to beat this game, if you're going for everything, you're largely employing the same tactics against him with minimal variation in the overall strategic approach. There are, of course, notable exceptions. The R&D section, for instance, offered some of the most distinct interactions with the Mimic's AI, And I really appreciate the secret bedtime sequence where your vision is limited and you're forced to rely more heavily on those stationary distractions and wind-up mice. That segment gave me the opportunity to pull off a few genuinely clever plays that I'm still proud of. But again, that's maybe 10% of the experience? For the other 90%, you're confronting the mimic in more or less the exact same fashion, regardless of his costume, aside from a few standout moments like the Jackie or Big Top spectacle sequences. Similar to DJ Music Man or the daycare attendant, Steelwool loves to create these intermissions from the normal gameplay formula to offer what I like to call spectacle sections to break up the foundational gameplay. But all this really does here is blend in with the gameplay loop, as not much changes to what you are foundationally doing, as all the spectacles are pretty much just chase sequences. I really think a nice way to bridge the gap between older fans who still enjoy the sit and survive formula would be to actually create sections where the players are in the standard office gameplay loop with cameras and such, as a way to break the sections when you are free roaming and running around. I also understand, from a lore perspective, that it's tricky to justify additional enemies coexisting with the mimic in his cat and mouse sections. But just imagine for a moment if the game introduced two completely new complementary robots, one that couldn't see and one that couldn't hear, alongside the mimic, whom had both senses but could spawn anywhere within the room. This trio would elevate the use of distraction tools, splitting them into auditory versus visual categories, and force the player to constantly recalibrate their approach while keeping tabs on the mimic's behavior. I think that additional complexity could have injected some really nice variety in the gameplay loop and allowed the players to pull off some really cool plays. But again, like the inventory system, these are conceptual expansions, ideas that I genuinely hope are explored further, especially if this is the foundation Steelwool intends to build upon in future FNAF titles. To its credit, the game does a solid job pacing mimic-centric cat and mouse segments with environmental augmentations, like the hospital doors that only the mimic can use, or the motion alarms triggered by mannequins in Chica's cupcakes in the Big Top and Part-Time Chica levels respectively. These touches add flavor, certainly, but ultimately, even with the environmental variations, you're still playing out the same core gameplay loop about 90% of the time. In fact, that 90% figure is probably the most accurate way to describe the experience of SOTM. Because while 90% of the time the game functions as intended, often quite well, we have to remember this is a Steelwool title. And as such, that remaining 10%? That's where things get a little quirky.
How'd you get back here?
Let's start with what I consider the Achilles heel of every Steelwool AI system so far. Elevations and inclines. Ever since we have gotten a peek behind the curtains into how Steelwool develops its animatronic pathfinding, it's clear that elevation changes, stairs, ramps, split levels, it just doesn't sit right with their AI. There's something about verticality that causes the animatronics to completely go brain dead or behave in ways that can only be described as just comically broken. One of the most consistent issues I've run into is when either the mimic or I is traversing stairs. For some reason, during these moments, the mimic seems to gain just X-ray vision, suddenly being able to see through solid walls. On multiple occasions, during both of my playthroughs, I was completely hidden behind cover or with just a sliver of my head peeking out from behind a cardboard box, and that was somehow enough for him to lock onto me. Yet in other moments, I could be half exposed in a wide open doorframe and he'd just stroll past without a second glance. There's also this strange phenomenon where if you're directly above or below the mimic in multi-level areas, he'll suddenly detect you despite there being an entire floor, walls, ceiling, and all between you. I noticed this a lot in the workshop section, but it cropped up again in both the retail room and the manor. It only seems to trigger when you're directly on top of him. Something about that spatial overlap seems to just trip his detection logic. I'm not entirely sure what's happening under the hood here, but my best guess is that there's a null value of some kind, some positional conflict that interferes with the mimic's perception logic, causing him to automatically detect you. Regardless of the exact cause, it happened a handful of times in both playthroughs. If you play the game yourself, odds are you'll run into it at least once. But again, 90% of the time, the Mimic's AI functions as intended. And within that intentional design, there are actually some clever ways to manipulate him. Something that speedrunners will no doubt have a field day with. One of the most notable exploits I discovered actually happened during my first playthrough, but I was able to confirm it as a repeatable tactic during my second. From what I can tell, the Mimic has a cap on how many alarms, lures, and sound cues he can respond to within a given window. So if you trigger multiple distractions in quick succession, such as in the admin office where cupcake alarms are at a sinful gluttonous abundant, you can effectively overload him. I found that by activating several lures rapidly, the Mimic would forgo any of the alarms I had tripped after the third or fourth discretion and only investigate those specific alarms. This let me just sprint straight through a stealth-heavy section while he was preoccupied, even though I was actively tripping other alarms along the way. But of course, not every aspect of the Mimic's design can be gamed. Sometimes, what's intentional still results in frustrating or undesirable behavior. Based on observation, his default prowling logic appears to be built around a pattern of movement between predetermined nodes. Each time he arrives at one of these positions, he pauses to survey the area, and then his next destination is selected via RNG, but only from a set of nodes within a certain radius of his current one. And interestingly, this seems to include the node he's already standing on, which means he can sometimes take a step forward only to immediately double back. It's a small detail, but it can catch you off guard, especially if he's close by, which can lead to some really, really funny deaths if you are impatient. The system is fine in theory. In effect, it's the same system used in Security Breach, but the RNG-driven behavior can occasionally back you into a corner. There are times I found myself effectively trapped as the Mimic kept circling my location without giving me a viable window to escape. And while that kind of tension can be compelling in short bursts, it can also become tedious if you're just stuck waiting for the dice to roll in your favor so you can finally make a move. Thankfully, there is a failsafe in place. If you're in an arena for a prolonged period of time and haven't made direct eye contact with the Mimic for an extended period, he will despawn and reappear nearby in a new costume. This includes costumes you may have been staring at the whole time. So, yes, it can break immersion a bit, but the system is clearly designed to keep things moving and avoid the Mimic puppet guarding a locker the player is hiding in. It works for the most part, but it's not quite seamless. With a bit of polish, though, I think it could become a solid foundation for more dynamic stealth encounters in future titles. Speaking of Mimic spawning behavior, that's another point of contention I have with the game, particularly in the late game. Eventually, you're bound to encounter situations where it becomes downright just unridiculous how the Mimic somehow manages to get ahead of you. My personal favorite is the lobby and the retail room, two areas that are literally adjacent. And one moment he's wandering around the first floor of the lobby, and the next, he's in the complete opposite end of the room you just entered in the retail room. But a special shoutout absolutely has to go out to the warehouse to admin office transition, where he somehow teleports from the first floor to the second with just zero discernible logic as to how he got there. Now I get it. This is sort of thing falls under the umbrella of suspension of disbelief, and it's not new to Security Breach or Steel Wolves games in general. But when there's only one roaming threat, it becomes far more noticeable. You start to really scrutinize his movement because he's the sole focal point of tension. And when he just pops into locations with no visible manner on how he could have possibly achieved that without you seeing, it does pull you out of the immersion and, subconsciously, makes you recognize you are indeed playing a video game. It's not a deal breaker by any means, but it is one of those lingering design quirks that sticks out, especially in a game where stealth and enemy positioning are so central to the gameplay loop. Performance and optimization-wise, I have to give credit where it's due. compared to the 150 gigabyte behemoth that was Security Breach. This game is a far leaner package. It takes up significantly less hardware space and, more importantly, runs much smoother than any previous Steel Wolf FNAF title. Outside of one major hiccup during the Big Top section, which, judging from streams by Astral Spiff and others, seems to be a widespread issue in need of patching, the game ran quite well. Occasional texture pop-ins aside, the experience was stable, with very few bugs or glitches beyond my recording software not really gelling well with the game for some reason. I'm not sure what that's about. The one major exception came during my New Game Plus playthrough. Things were going great. I made it to 4 a.m, achieved the bad ending, collected all the secret collectibles, and even completed the moon.exe sequence. Then, as I initiated the program to access the R&D lab, the game failed to load the button that activated the elevator lift. Unsure of what to do, I backtracked, something told me to check the balcony area. Strangely enough, the previously locked door leading back to the main facility had become accessible. I turned the handle, walked through, and was immediately launched into the void, soft-locked in an infinite loading screen. Okay, so here's my theory. From 12 a.m. to 4 a.m, the game likely doesn't load the R&D section to conserve memory. And once 4 a.m. hits, when you're supposed to be locked out of the rest of the MCM facility, the game unloads everything except the linear path forward. Normally, this wouldn't be an issue, except when you reload the save. Because upon restarting, I found myself back on the balcony. This time the button to activate the R&D lift did appear, but the minor lift to reach the first floor was stuck on said first floor, inaccessible from my current position. Because the rest of the MCM facility remains unloaded, I am now completely softlocked with no way to progress. So until a patch is released, I am essentially trapped. Hello, Future Nick here. Turns out they did patch this, so thankfully, no one should be stuck there anymore. This same patch also mentioned that the Big Top Music Man section was also fixed for optimization. I've yet to test how well the performance is now, but judging from recent playthroughs, it seems like that's all good to go as well. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. Let's see, what else can I talk about before we dive into the game's story? I know I really like this game, I think. Am I forgetting any other praise worth mentioning? Here we go. The VA performances. This game features some exquisite performances from the entire voice cast. Now, I know everyone's talking about the Murray family right now, and for good reason, but if we're being honest, the stand-up performance for me has to go to Andy Field. Going from the monotone deadpan voice we all remember booting up Sister Location to finally getting a role he can really sink his teeth into, it's fantastic to see. This isn't to say his work as the various units wasn't iconic, but for fans unfamiliar with Andy's broader range, this is long overdue showcase for just how good he really is. It's exciting to hear that level of nuance and presence in a FNAF title from Andy. The entire cast also delivers across the board. There honestly isn't a weak link in the lineup, I think. I will say it was a bit disappointing we didn't get a Christopher McCullough back for the Foxy cameo, but Killen did a great job bringing his own flavor to the performance. Speaking of Killen, he also voiced your player character Arnold, who... Alright, no disrespect to Killen here, but I did not care for Arnold as a character. Similar to Gregory in Security Breach, Arnold doesn't speak much, especially during moments when he really should have something to say, and that lack of engagement hurts the immersion just a bit. We also don't get any really insight into his backstory, which is odd because we haven't really had a non-important player character since FNAF 2. Michael acted as protagonist in every other mainline game. We play as William and UCN, and all the Steel Wolf protagonists up until now have either had voices, implied backstories, or meaningful ties to the overarching lore. But Arnold, he's just kind of there. Which, that's not a problem. It's just when strange things are happening all around him, his silence feels less like an artistic choice and more like missed opportunity. Just because he doesn't have anyone to talk to doesn't mean we couldn't hear his internal monologue, some narration, some sense of thought, something to flesh him out beyond being an avatar for the player, right? I was really hoping Moon.exe would be the moment we got more development from him, maybe a deeper dive into Arnold's motivations or how he got involved in this whole situation with Fazbear's. But sadly, that wasn't the case. And without that extra layer of character, it's hard not to feel a bit disconnected from him, even when everything else around him is so well realized. Just feels like a missed opportunity, you know? Let's see here. The game's soundtrack, particularly during the chase sequences, is genuinely excellent. It's not an overwhelming library of tracks, but what does exist is exceptionally well crafted and fits the tone of the game beautifully. There's this strange vintage aesthetic threaded throughout the entire experience. From the very start, the game opens with an old camera reel effect, and many of these chase themes carry a kind of Victorian steampunk inspiration, especially Dolly's Chase, with that eerie organ-heavy composition. Add in the elaborate wallpaper designs and the imposing Victorian manor itself, and you get this strong, cohesive, gothic vibe that really sets SOTM apart from previous SteelWorld projects. I love that choice. The almost gothic undertones and overall atmosphere feels much more in line with what the series was originally known for, as opposed to the neon-drenched indoor amusement park meets capitalist utopia we got with Security Breach. I also know I briefly went over the chase sequences before, and while I know some have complaints surrounding them, I personally think they're fine. I enjoy them. Between the pacing, the music, and the environmental design, these segments are consistently tense and well-constructed. SteelWorld did a tremendous job keeping the stakes high, introducing verticality, interactable elements that genuinely enhance the experience. It's an elevation of what they offered in Security Breach and Ruin, and even feels like a clever response to games like Poppy's Playtime, which are infamous for going overboard with chase segments. So TM knows when to press and when to give the player space, and that balance makes all the difference. Speaking of design, the Mimic's costumes are a real standout here. SteelWorld clearly poured a lot of love into creating a variety of disguises for the Mimic to wear. Mushroom men, dogs, lions, elephants, hedgehogs, and even a retro Chica outfit at one point. There's one section in the workshop where he dons a stripped-down costume, just bare shelves devoid of any unique features, and they're all just so creepy. I love it. Now, none of the characters in themselves, I think, are in equal footing design of any of the animatronic lineups in terms of memorability, but then again, they don't really need to be. There was only one quote-unquote outfit I thought was a little stupid. The character in the bedtime section is just absolutely ridiculous. Those stubby T-Rex arms were goofy, just no getting around that. But honestly, the gameplay in that section was solid enough that I could forgive it. Plus, considering how much variety there is across the board, the bumblebee, the jester, the constant shifting in color palettes and patterns, it's actually rare to see the Mimic in the same costume twice during a standard playthrough, which is impressive. All in all, this is a tremendous game in terms of gameplay, and if you were someone who felt that Security Breach infantilized the franchise, or if you were let down by how streamlined Ruin was, or how disappointed Help Wanted 2 turned out, SOTM does a lot to win back the trust of longtime FNAF fans who preferred the Scott-era formula without making a total return to form. Really, my only significant complaint regarding the gameplay is that absence of the traditional camera system or classic security office segment. That was, after all, the bedrock of the original FNAF identity. But given what we did get in the R&D section, I can honestly say I am satisfied. Even though I still want to see a return to the classic sit and survive gameplay loop outside of the VR games, what R&D offered was really solid evolution of that idea, even if the lore tied into it was absolute trash. Okay, I guess we've reached that point. Yep, we gotta talk about it. Alright, let's get to what everyone's been waiting for. The inevitable Nick Black crash out. Just a fair warning, major spoilers ahead. From this point on, I will not be holding my tongue. Every reveal, every plot twist, it's all on the table. You have been warned. Now, like I said before, SOTM is SteelWorld's FNAF 4, a game that excels in atmosphere, design, gameplay, and presentation, up until you try to actually integrate it into the wider franchise. That's when the gears start to grind and things stop making sense. Let's begin with the titular Secret of the Mimic. The big mid-game reveal isn't just that there are two Mimic entities, but that the original mimic is now inhabited by Edwin Murray's wife, Fiona's spirit, or at the very least, a remnant echo of her memories. And the mimic's original purpose wasn't to be a friend for David, it was to create a replacement for the wife Edwin lost.
You serious?
Now, to be fair, I saw the twist of multiple mimic endos coming to some degree. I even predicted it in some capacity back during our Mimic Explained before MatPat Overcomplicates it video. Which, again, I feel like I need to elaborate again for some people. That episode was a cheeky jab at how convoluted Mimic lore was, especially with the way the FNAF Twitter sphere simultaneously glazed over its issues while MatPat took heat for trying to make sense of it all. In that episode, Alix and I, amid our usual chaos, pointed out that even within the Tales from the Pizzaplex continuity, the Mimic was somehow in multiple places at once. Not just its code, like in Gregory or Vanessa's head, but physically present in different locations simultaneously. In that continuity, it was both buried beneath the Pizzaplex and plugged into the storyteller at the same time. So that left us with two possibilities. Either A, the writers made a mistake, or B, there are multiple physical mimics. I didn't think A was likely because Andrea Wagner, who, as far as I know, wrote every mimic-centric story, should logically know her own continuity within her specific novellas. And it turns out I was right about the multiple mimic endos, but not in the way I expected. Because what SOTM does isn't just reveal multiple mimics, it more or less abandons the original source material entirely. This is perhaps my biggest criticism with SOTM's plot, because in essence, this is a story that originates from a book, one which is required reading to fully grasp the narrative of a video game series. This in turn necessitated the creation of a game adaptation of that very book, meant to bring the gaming audience up to speed with lore established in a secondary medium. Yet paradoxically, the game cherry-picks elements it favors while freely altering or discarding others, rendering the original source material effectively obsolete. Yet despite this, crucial lore not explored within the game remains confined exclusively to the books, such as how David even died, making the core story obsolete, but not certain other details that leave the reading to fill in. That is so f***ing stupid it physically hurts. This change also impacts the character of Fiona, who has now been retconned, no longer dying in childbirth with David, but instead surviving for 3 more years before dying in a fire during Fallfest. And let's just be honest, that Fallfest connection, that was absolutely Scott and Steeble finally trying to get the theorist community to shut the hell up about it. For like years, FNAF theorists and YouTubers have obsessed over Fallfest. So what do? They tied it to Fiona's death and effectively closed the book on it. And frankly, I don't blame them. Fallfest was never supposed to be anything important. It was just supposed to be a thematic setting for Curse of Dreadbear from the beginning, and trying to bury it here was probably the cleanest way to move on. No fault there, but don't act like this was planned when they originally teased Fallfest back in 1983, but alter it here to be 1978, when they finally have a use for it. Again, no fault, it wasn't supposed to be important, and a Steelwool developer in Darko's interview with them for SOTM basically even said so.
I feel like you guys have been teasing about like this, like for a while with like the Fall Fest posters and stuff. It always feels like you've had it like in your heads for a while.
Yeah, it's one of the fun things of working on a franchise like this is that we can look like really far in the future, and maybe we don't know exactly what forms things are going to take, but we kind of see where we want to go and start laying some groundwork in the games that we make.
Where I do place fault, however, is in the absolute character shift forced onto Edwin and the Mimic's origin. In the original Mimic novella, Edwin was a deeply empathetic and sympathetic figure, a grieving father who had lost the love of his life and was now juggling the impossible balance of single parenthood, career obligations, and personal grief. He gave up on his dreams, sold out his ideals, and created the mimic as a gift for his son, a helper, a companion, and something to monitor David, distract him, and keep him company while Edwin worked. So when tragedy struck, and when David died from some random event of life, it was heartbreaking. The moment where Edwin sees this thing, this robot, mimicking his son's gestures, being David in all but soul, that's what sent him in a downward spiral of grief and rage. And it's beautiful in a haunting literary way. But now, that entire emotional core has been rewritten. Now the mimic is no longer a labor of love or a desperate attempt to salvage fatherhood. It's a Frankenstein's monster, cobbled together from Edwin's prior inventions. The Macellian Man's voice replay system, the Clinovax expansion and compression components, and the stay-up latte machine's observation learning behavior. And look, on paper, I don't mind expanding the mimic's capabilities with tangible links to previous inventions from Murray. That's fine, that's lore building. But what I take great issue with is the new through line, that being the reason behind the mimic's creation. Instead of being a gift to his living son, the mimic is now positioned as a robotic attempt to recreate Edwin's deceased wife, essentially repeating the Henry Emily plotline from the novel trilogy. The man who loses someone falls into a depressive spiral and tries to recreate that lost love as a robotic doppelganger. It's a story concept we've seen before, and in this context, it cheapens Edwin to some degree. Now, to be fair, it's not a perfect one-to-one with Henry. There's no illusion disc nonsense here. And the game does make it very clear the mimic is just a bare, metallic endoskeleton. But that almost makes it worse, because the narrative wants us to believe that Edwin is so far gone, so mentally deteriorated, that he willingly plays into the fantasy that this cold, mechanical thing is his wife. It's unsettling, but not in the right way. It feels like it undercuts the tragedy of Edwin's original story, which was grounded in human grief, love, and loss. That story didn't need to be rewritten. It was already powerful. But this does change the entire rationale behind why Evan even attacked the mimic in the first place. And let's be clear, Scott knows this, and he does try to retroactively justify it. Near the end of the game, we're given audio logs that attempt to patch this new logic together. That Edwin originally built M1, which only worked because Fiona's spirit, or remnant, attached itself to M1. When David died, M1 tried to convince him to recreate his son with M2, failed, and, upon realizing the years he'd wasted, transformed M1, or at the very least its code, into MXES, aka Georgina, because I still despise that character in every capacity. She's a MacGuffin that does whatever the plot demands in every capacity, and her lore is trash. And what about M2? I guess he kept it around until one day this specific machine pissed him off enough to warrant a full-on beatdown, while his fake robot wife just gets buried into some sci-fi sarcophagus? None of it makes really any sense. In the original Tales novella, Edwin's breakdown was perfectly paced and emotionally devastating. His rage wasn't delayed. It came from a moment of emotional vulnerability in the moment. After burying his son and surviving a period of disassociation, he finally wakes up. But what is there to greet him? A robot mimicking the actions of the child he just lost. Not with malice, not even awareness, just fulfilling its programming. That's what broke Edwin. A ghost in metaphor of his son that he failed to care for. And it was that outburst, filled with raw grief and pain, that imbued the mimic with agony and how he learned aggression and violence. It made sense, it was tragic, and it fit Five Nights at Freddy's. But now we got this tangled, contradictory sequence where Edwin builds M1 to replace Fiona, David dies, somehow M1 convinces him to build M2, he finally realizes, after a string of failures, that he's lost the plot completely, and decides one robot gets entombed and the other gets shattered? It's incoherent and adds so much unnecessary in-between that could have just been solved by sticking to the original narrative and not overbloating it. And while we're on the subject of Edwin, talk about character assassination. Wow, he is a complete asshole in this game. Sure, he has some sympathetic traits left. He's not full-blown William Afton. But most of the nuance and quiet nobility that made him compelling in the novella is gone, replaced with what I can only describe as dark comedy and exaggerated eccentricity. In the original tales, Edwin sells his company to Fazbear Entertainment not out of greed, but necessity. His vacuum cleaner product line is failing, and he needs financial security to provide for his son. It's a deal with the devil, but one we can understand. A man doing what he has to do for his child. That version of Edwin is relatable. And so TM, however, that's retconned. The vacuum isn't his only invention. He's apparently this manic, overambitious tech wizard with his fingers in every possible pie. Robot coat racks, sentient vacuums, AI-driven coffee machines, children's entertainment mascots, you name it. His creativity is boundless, but so is his hubris, and it drags down everyone around him. He's no longer a man worn down by grief. He's a man who burned out his employees, spread himself too thin, and has no time for his son by choice, and ultimately caused his own downfall. Not through tragedy, but through reckless overreach. And that's the new tragedy, not of a father broken by loss, but of a failed tech mogul who flew too close to the sun. Which, again, is fine in another story, but that wasn't Edwin's story. Not originally. This is also where Fazbear Entertainment comes into play, and honestly, I don't mind this change. I actually do appreciate it. Instead of Edwin's company being bought out by some generic Fazbear lackey, the game specifically makes it William Afton, who swoops in and starts to turn the screws. SOTM does an excellent job illustrating just how masterfully manipulative and ruthlessly cutthroat William was in life as a businessman. He elevates Edwin with empty promises of salvaging his failing business, dangling the prospect of just one successful job with his company, and all his employees will come back and his father's company will be saved. All the meanwhile, he exploits the low morale at MCM that Edwin fostered, donning his pirate hat and goes corporate raiding, poaching Edwin's staff and coaxing them to jump ship, while simultaneously stealing Edwin's secrets, schematics, blueprints, and tech in exchange for prestigious jobs and bonuses, courtesy of Fazbear Entertainment. It's diabolical, and it reinforces how William, even when not the primary antagonist, remains a puppeteer behind so much of the FNAF universe's evil. His underhanded maneuvers stoke Edwin's paranoia, pushing him to distrust nearly everyone, and accelerating his descent into the maelstrom of depression and fractured reality of his soul. It adds some nice layers to the characters of both William and Edwin. That said, I do think it's possible to showcase William's cold business acumen without completely undermining Edwin's original characterization from the books. I mean, for God's sakes, at one point, Edwin flat out tells his wife that employees getting trapped and endangered by faulty elevators are killing his creative mood, as if their lives didn't matter at all. And that is a smaller gripe I have with the setting as a whole. The characterization of both the MCM and Fazbear Entertainment feels nearly indistinguishable. I had the same issue with the modern era games, where Afton Robotics and Fazbear seem interchangeable, despite such a location explicitly differentiating them. The SteelWorld developers have even stated this is not a Fazbear facility. So why do MCM and Fazbear share the same disingenuous, indifferent attitude toward employee welfare? If you strip some of the dialogue between Edwin and Dispatch down to just text on paper, you would be hard-pressed to believe these characters represent two distinct corporate entities within the same fictional universe. I get that FNAF embraces a dark sense of humor and likes satirizing exploitive entertainment conglomerates. But for once, can we have a business that isn't just anarcho-capitalism in disguise? Something different beyond the usual profit over people trope, please, for once. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. Another retcon that has quite a few members of the fandom raising eyebrows is the change regarding who actually invented the spring lock suits. Now, yes, technically this game is just reinforcing what Phone Guy said in his FNAF 3 training tapes, that the Springlock suits were developed by a third party, not by Fazbear Entertainment itself, with Edwin Murray now being the revealed source of their creation. But let's not kid ourselves, for the better part of the last 6 to 7 years, the broader fandom has largely accepted the novel trilogy's account, even if it is non-canon, which distinctly credits Henry Emily as the mind behind the Springlock technology. Now, I want to bring something up. A lot of people who read the Springlock lore in this game seem to fall for Edwin's optimistic spin regarding their safety. There are multiple notes and logs referencing injuries among staff members. Fiona explicitly calls the suits dangerous, and Edwin himself admits to her that, even with water damage, the suits are quote-unquote ready for the diner. They'll need to speak with Henry about other concerns. And if we're treating this as an explanation for the FNAF 3 tape's mentions of outside manufacturers, then we also need to remember what else Phone Guy said in that same set of recordings.
Do not breathe on the spring lock, as moisture may loosen them and cause them to break loose. In the case that the spring locks come loose while you're wearing a suit, please try to maneuver away from populated areas before bleeding out, as to not ruin the customer experience.
I'm going to pretend that didn't happen.
So, no. Edwin didn't invent some safer version of the Springlock suits. Nor did he create a refined model superior to Henry's. Springlock suits were always a catastrophic liability. Edwin rushed them into production to meet deadlines. He even suggests that they can just get teens to wear them. Henry, to his credit, was the one who pushed back against them. And look, I get the intent here behind that decision. Henry, as he's portrayed in FNAF 6, is a man burdened by the weight of his past, someone with a clear moral compass. So reframing him not as the architect of those reverse bear trap disguised as cartoon mascots, but as the man who opposed their use, that makes more narrative sense. It elevates Edwin's lore relevance and reinforces Henry's role as Fazbear's moral center, a man who, like Edwin, was ultimately manipulated by William Afton. But still, doesn't this revision somewhat render Henry redundant? Yes, he still created the original cast of animatronics, Freddy, Bonnie, Chica, and Foxy. He built the security puppet, he designed Lefty, he maybe even made Balloon Boy, Fredbear's singing show. But in terms of the company's formation, he now feels weirdly peripheral. William has always been depicted as the businessman of the enterprise. Henry was the artist, the craftsman. But now it feels like that dynamic has been tilted to the point that Henry almost feels pointless in this duo. I mean, what exactly was Fredbear's singing show, and how did Henry play a role in it? Was it just a mascot suit he designed? Was it Cake Bear? Some prototype robot Henry made off to the side? If you're going to make sweeping changes to the lore, especially ones this foundational, you can't just sideline a legacy character like Henry, particularly not when the game devotes so much internal documentation to building up William Afton as this meticulous, cold figure who methodically dismantled Edwin's company for his own gain. You can't both elevate Afton and erase the other architect of Fazbear's rise. It just leaves the foundation feeling lopsided. Speaking of which, the Fazbear Project. One of the game's other major reveals is that Edwin had developed prototypes of what we recognize as the original FNAF 1 band. Though, interestingly, this band wasn't just Freddy, Bonnie, Chica, and Foxy. It also included a Spring Bonnie, Spring Fredbear, a Spring Monty, and even a Spring Blub, which is clearly a nod to Sparky the Dog, which is really cool. In the R&D wing, there's a large-scale prototype layout of the original FNAF 1 restaurant, which does lead into one of my favorite gameplay sequences in SOTM. You have to use the spring lock suits to trigger doors and reduce the building's power levels, essentially playing through FNAF 1 in reverse to access the security office. It's a fantastic moment, not only mechanically satisfying, but also a clever twist on the familiar territory. It even expands on that spring lock mechanic we only briefly saw earlier in the workshop section, where the Mimic, just like the robots in FNAF 2, can't tell you are a human underneath the mascot costume. Now, where I see a lot of misinterpretation here with the lore surrounding this area is the suggestion that Henry and William stole the concept for the Fazbear Band from Edwin. No. Edwin was, after all, a contractor. And if Chica and Foxy appear as part of the Fazbear project, then logically, they'd just be commissioned through Edwin's contributions. That would mean Chica's party world was likely the first point of real contact between Edwin and the Henry William duo, a professional collaboration that gradually turned personal. Edwin calling Henry Hen hints at a deeper familiarity, a friendship, possibly rooted in their early working relationship. But more to the point, this entire section seems to be contextualizing where the new designs for the original band came from post-Bite of 87, after the withered animatronics were decommissioned during the company's reorganization. It appears Fazbear Entertainment either reconnected with Edwin, assuming he survived this game, or simply repurposed blueprints and schematics from the late 70s to rebuild the band. That said, the game could have communicated this idea more clearly. The Fazbear project seems poised to be this game's big FFPS-style reveal, but it never quite finds the right words to articulate its own significance. One or two additional logs could have gone a long way, especially a conversation between Henry and William with Edwin. The absence of that feels like a real missed opportunity, if I'm being honest. And yes, just to circle back on something I mentioned earlier, Edwin may be dead by the end of this story. There's no body. But if we go by Tales from the Pizzaplex, he should survive until just before the events of Security Breach. But even that is murky. The game seems to cherry-pick what it wants from the books rather than adhering to them in a structured way. And look, I think this is a central frustration for me and for many FNAF fans who care deeply about the franchise's world-building. Back during Fazbear Frights, the main criticism was that those stories didn't align with the core canon, effectively treating themselves like an alternate universe. And that was fine once in the AU novel trilogy. But there's only so many times we can invest ourselves in a world that ends up being a facsimile of the one we're actually interested in exploring. That's why Tales from the Pizzaplex felt like a course correction. It made a genuine effort to tether its stories to the main continuity, embedding lore directly into the game elements like the arcade cabinets in GGY, and even bridging connections to Help Wanted, FNAF 4, and Sister Location. For the first time in a while, the books didn't feel random, they felt canonical and part of the world of FNAF. We want the stories to be canon. Fans have made that clear for years, but Tales occasionally felt like an overcorrection. Yes, the books can influence the games and add depth to the world, but the core continuity, the essential plot, should still be understandable without needing to consult external media. At this point, though, it feels like Scott has reversed course yet again, unlearning the lesson he appeared to absorb. Rather than working in tandem with the books, the games now seem to actively fight against and contradict them. Yet paradoxically, crucial game-related lore is still being buried in the books. what we're left with is this tangled meat pretzel of contradictions, where neither medium cleanly supports the other. Take a few examples. How did David die? The game never tells us. We know he died near his playground from the game's implication, but you would be forgiven if only your first run-through that you just presumed William killed him or M1. Why is the mimic under the pizzaplex? No explanation in the games themselves. That story is found only in the epilogues of the books, the same books whose stories are one-to-one with the games. This approach, this methodology of playing fast and loose with internal inconsistency, feels not only creatively disjointed, but just also self-sabotaging. Because the story alters so much, it is stuck in between telling its own story and adapting the mimic novella. An issue that wasn't really apparent with something like Into the Pit, even with its alterations. So we don't find there to be a convenient excuse for why the same ends could not be achieved here for the sake of bridging both mediums and maintaining continuity. That is, unless Tales from the Pizzaplex is not canon, in which case that is a large discussion that the fandom needs to have about how pointless the books are and how the fandom is paying for QA testing Scott's story ideas, which is egregious. Do I think that's his intention? No. But intentions don't negate outcomes. And frankly, the result of these decisions is exploitative, even if it wasn't meant to be. Either way you slice it, this was a bad call. Now, I understand why I, someone who literally has a job dissecting FNAF lore, would buy the books. And sure, every major FNAF content creator is going to read them too. But why should anyone else? Why should a casual fan feel compelled to pick up an entire book series just to understand what's happening in the games? Especially if they're not going to maintain continuity between both mediums. What frustrates me most is that he could have done it right. The framework is already there. He could have used the books to enhance the games while still delivering core narrative beats to players who don't engage with the supplemental material. Just look at what Sister Location did for FNAF 4. It didn't throw old lore out, it clarified it, elevated it, expanded upon it, gave it cohesion. Or, if you're going to expand the original story, again, Into the Pit showed you could do that while still not altering the entire storyline in the process. Again, it feels like we're back in FNAF 4 territory, all over again, left dangling at the edge of yet another cryptid, fragmented cliffhanger, still waiting for a proper narrative anchor. Speaking of cliffhangers, let's talk about that ending and how it sucked. Oh my god. Enough already. I am so sick and tired of these endless cliffhanger endings in Five Nights at Freddy's in the Steel Wool era. Just tell a complete story, or don't bother telling me one at all. I am beyond exhausted being strung along like this. This game's endings. Okay. Let's break them down. There's three endings you can achieve. There's the blatantly bad ending, where the mimic kills you. That's it. There's the clearly non-canon ending, where we deactivate the mimic by age regressing it back into its David form, which, okay. And finally, the only one that is likely canon, Arnold burns down MZM while the mimic causes his car to crash when he flees. And instead of killing him on the spot, it just takes his data diver with executive access, because that's apparently all it ever wanted, leaving Arnold to die in the fire. But wait, hold on. So you're telling me the mech had access to the entire facility the whole time, and all it actually needed or wanted was executive access? And it couldn't get that from literally any of the data divers carried by the other Fazbear recovery teams he killed? Or this is an MCM facility which these are more than likely produced, and he couldn't find one anywhere? Seriously? And I guess we can just forget about the critical system Fiona kept talking about, or why she wanted executive access in the first place. Because apparently, in every ending, the mimic can just leave whenever it feels like. Unless the cradle Arnold activates was just for burning the whole place down, in which case, sure, I guess. What better way to limit the mimic's ability to harm people by making it have to relocate somewhere else? But none of these conclusions address the actual questions we still have about the mimic, which, in actuality, was kind of the point of this game. To tie the backstory of the mimic that was related to the books, the main storyline of the games, while answering some crucial questions not answered in both mediums. Who brought it to the Pizzaplex during its construction? Why did the Freddy Fazbear Pizza Place in FNAF 6 sink underground? Who delivered it to Silver Parasol Games so it could be scanned into the Freddy Fazbear virtual experience? Why does it have a connection to William Afton? Does it have a connection to Molten Freddy / the Blob? Why did it take the form of Glitztrap, and by extension, manipulate Vanessa into becoming Vanny? How did Fazbear Entertainment even acquire the mimic in the first place? How did Fazbear Entertainment come back from the brink despite the fact that FFBS states it's no longer a corporate entity? Or, here's a fun one. What is the mimic's actual motivation now? In the original story, it didn't really have one. That was kind of the point. It was a corrupted program, warped by exposure to something paranormal and experiencing something it never should have seen. Its motivations were simply primal. And that worked. It made the mimic feel like a force of nature. Terrifying, relentless, and a demon forged by the raw emotions and sins of its creator. That ambiguity and tie into raw grief was compelling. But now it apparently has a personality, one explicitly modeled on Edwin. Or at the very least, it can transfer itself into any personality it has. I don't know how that makes sense. And that final ending, it implied that Mimic's creating its own twisted abominations, mimicking Edwin's inventive spirit out of sheer spite. But still, what does it want? Is it just vengeful? Is there an actual goal? Is it chaos incarnate? Because if that's true, then why didn't it just kill Arnold and take the data diver? Why did it just leave him for dead? It clearly has a plan, but what is that plan? Does it have a plan, or is it just going through the motions? I guess I'll just have to wait for the next DLC to find out. Secret of the Mimic, Funtime Armageddon. Let's take a breather. Let's step back for a moment. What are my final thoughts on this game? Well, and I know this is going to shock some of my longtime followers, Steel Wool cooked. Seriously, everything that came from Steel Wool's side of this game in terms of design decisions and craftsmanship showed real growth. There was clear adherence to feedback here, a visible commitment to course correction and a genuine responsiveness to what the audience has been asking for. The gameplay is fluid, and repeat playthroughs, I think they're going to be a blast. I can honestly see this becoming the Luigi's Mansion of Five Nights at Freddy's. One of those games people replay from start to finish in a long single setting. It's perfect for casual speedrunning and 100% completion, no question. There are some changes I would like to see in the format in the future. Again, I think you can make the majority of fans happy by not doing chase sequences, but instead implementing traditional FNAF office gameplay in between the free roam sections as a way to break the formula and add breathing room to the game's pacing. And I think more needs to be done with the animatronic AI, and add different tactics you can use in the game's cat and mouse sections. But then we get to the narrative. And while the story this game tells is one I genuinely enjoyed, and yes, it's leagues better than the disjointed mess we got in Security Breach, it still stumbles in all too familiar ways at this point. Fractured continuity, half-baked worldbuilding, and the same persistent issues with bland protagonists, disappointing endings, and a kind of over-reliance on dark corporate humor that's long since lost its bite. And as much as it pains me to say it, that's on Scott Cawthon. He is the only one credited for writing in this game, which tells me the narrative decisions were his 100% alone, and unfortunately, even with the chance to finally bridge the gap between the game and the books, to truly unify the FNAF universe and elevate both the mediums in the eyes of the community, he instead chose to double down on the dissonance between them. rather than bringing cohesion, we got further convolution. The lore clashes, and what we're left with, and this is perhaps the harshest critique I can give, is a worse adaptation of the original Mimic story. I mean, look, if I want to show someone what the Mimic is like as an antagonist, I'll recommend them play Secret of the Mimic. But if I just want to give someone a damn good story, I'll hand them the Mimic novella. Even with its own lore complications, and yes, they exist even in the novella, it tells a clearer, more focused, and ultimately more compelling tale. And here's the frustrating part. This game could have cleaned that up. It had the opportunity to clarify, to connect, to expand. But instead, it decided to hit the reset button again. So what we have here is a great game, one that proves SteelWool can develop excellent FNAF experiences outside of Scott's core work. They've laid the groundwork for something truly special here, 5 years later down the line, but hey, better late than never. And I sincerely hope they continue building on it because, again, please do not abandon systems like the inventory tubes or the randomized spawn mechanics. Those are brilliant innovations that deserve credit absolutely on SteelWool's part. Do I think the game is worth the full $40? Honestly, no. But at $30 on sale? Absolutely. It is a must-play for any FNAF fan or horror game enthusiast. At the end of the day, this game does shine in a vacuum. It's not perfect, but the imperfections don't come from the developers. They come from the top. I know I sound like a broken record when I say this, but please, Scott, hire a continuity consultant. Someone whose entire job is to keep the lore coherent, to maintain immersion, and to make sure that every dark corner still holds a mystery worth chasing and maintain its lore consistency with every new addition to the franchise. I'm genuinely excited to see what SteelWool is cooking next. But Scott's story direction? That honestly terrifies me. And that just feels wrong. By the way, everyone who claims Edwin totally made safer versions of Springlocks because of the fall in the puppet theater, you know in this very same game, Arnold falls like several stories and is absolutely fine here too, without a spring suit to, I guess, cushion his fall. Arnold is just built different, guys. That is clearly the lore reveal here.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.